On January 29, 2019, Dr. Jonathan Patz of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, professor and director of the Global Health Institute, as well as 2007 Nobel Peace Prize winner, delivered a lecture at Montana State University Bozeman's Procrastinator Theater entitled Climate Change Effects on Allergies and Infectious Diseases. He was introduced by MSU Professor of Disease Ecology and Epidemiology, Dr. Raina Plowright.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to introduce Professor Jonathan Patz. Jonathan is originally a medical doctor, but he told me not to depend on him in an emergency. And that's basically because Jonathan's patient is the planet. His day job is Professor and John P. Holton Chair of Health and the Environment at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he also directs the Global Health Institute. So Jonathan has this long list of accomplishments, but notably, first, he was a co-recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize. Sorry, I probably don't need to say more, but I will. Dr. Patz co-chaired the health expert panel of the first congressional-mandated U.S. assessment on climate change. He was a convening lead author for the International Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. And for 14 years, Dr. Patz was a lead author for the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, that you will have all heard of. And it's for this that he shared the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore and the other IPCC lead authors. In 1994, Patz convened the first ever session on climate change for the American Public Health Association and authored the organization's first policy resolution on climate change in 1995. He organized the first climate change health briefings to the EPA, the EPA administration. He's been invited to brief both houses of Congress and serve on scientific committees of the National Academy of Sciences. He was the founding president of the International Association for Ecology and Health, and I have this long list of awards that he has been given, and they all sound very prestigious. I won't read them, though. He's written over 100 peer-reviewed papers, many reports, two edited textbooks, and an encyclopedia on global environmental health. And he has a TED Talk. I'll hand it over to Jonathan now. Thank you. Thanks.
Raina, you're too kind with your introduction. The most important thing is that I'm a colleague of Raina's and her husband's, Gary. That's my biggest claim to fame. It's really an honor to be out here and to enjoy the environs of Bozeman, because where I live in Madison, Wisconsin, at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning, it will be negative 30 with a wind chill of negative 55. So I'm going to talk today about climate change and what it means for allergies and infectious diseases and a little bit more. But before we get there, I just want to quickly remind you what the greenhouse effect is. And because there is a real climatologist, David Carlson, from the World Meteorological Organization, if I say anything wrong, please correct me on the climate stuff. So the greenhouse effect, of course, is sunlight. Energy comes through the atmosphere, and the infrared heat is reflected back. It's trapped. It's why we have a nice climate on Earth compared to a place like Mars. But if that blanket, that blue blanket, builds up, it's going to be trapping more heat. Has the Earth been warming? This is data from Jim Hansen showing summers in the Northern Hemisphere. And as you watch what happens over time, I want you to pay particular attention to the extremely hot days. Very few extremely hot days in the night from 1950 to 1980. But look at what happens over time. 83 to 93, 94 to 2004, 2005 to 2015. It really is getting warmer. Now, we've looked at what will happen in the future. We looked at cities east of the Mississippi and found that by mid-century, we will see a tripling in the number of very hot days. Like, for example, New York City right now has 13 days that are 90 degrees Fahrenheit or warmer. By mid-century, they'll have 39 days, a tripling in the number of very hot days. So, of course, that's concerning if you're worried about people being exposed to heat waves. Some news Very recently, just a few weeks ago, Greenland's ice is melting 4 times faster than we thought. And Greenland's ice sheet, if it melts, sea levels will rise 23 feet or 7 meters. But Greenland is much smaller than the Antarctic, which also has been found to be losing ice 6 times faster than previously. And if you want to get to the details, you can talk to Dr. Carlson after the lecture, because he could tell you why this is happening and why we're discovering this. This is pretty startling news. So here's just an example of Greenland, and you can see the extent of seasonal ice melt. Well, here in Montana, how many of you have heard of a place called Glacier National Park? So the U.S. Geological Survey has a project called the Repeat Photography Project, where on the same calendar day, they take a photograph and they repeat that photograph every 5 or 10 years. I don't know the sequence, to be honest, but here's a photograph of Glacier, of Boulder Glacier in 1932, and the same place, same calendar day in 1988. So certainly the things are happening on the ground. In the Arctic is warming much faster than at lower latitudes. You can see this is the extent of ice September of 1980, and here is September 2007. If you think I'm cherry picking, you can look at a graph and it's showing that in fact the Arctic is really warming faster than models predicted. Now, at dinner with Dr. Carlson a couple nights ago, he explained that if you have open Arctic Ocean, that can affect how long you see these extreme cold waves. There's something called Arctic amplification. Doctors Francis and Vavris described this about 7 years ago. The reason that you have the jet stream moving is that there's a difference in temperature from the cold Arctic down to lower latitudes. And as the Arctic is warming, the temperature difference gets smaller, which means you have less power driving the jet stream. So instead of being wavy like this, it becomes a deeper wave. And what Dr. Carlson told me is that because of the open Arctic Ocean, more open ocean, this wave will maintain itself. So you won't just have 1 day of extreme cold, you'll have a full week. So this is what things look like on Saturday. And this is my hometown, Madison, Wisconsin, at 14 below zero. And I was up at Lone Mountain Ranch where it was positive 36. So 50 degrees difference. This happened before in 2014. Here's the United States with this Arctic cold. And the North Pole was very warm, as was Russia and other parts of the world. So today, Chicago is colder than parts of Antarctica, Alaska, and Iceland. So again, when you think about climate change and the term, you don't say global warming, because you could get some really weird things happening, especially as the Arctic disintegrates. And a lot of people think about this typical image of climate change and the melting ice and the polar bears going extinct. But I'm here to talk about climate change effects on our species, on our health. Now, the physical attributes of climate change, rising temperatures, rising sea level, both from land-based glaciers melting, but also simply from thermal expansion of salt water. And the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change projections are extremely conservative because their projections are only the thermal expansion of salt water, the warmer ocean temperature. And they're not factoring in that possible 7 meter rise if Greenland slips into the ocean and the 57 meter rise if the Antarctic goes. And extremes of the water cycle, more droughts, floods, and fires. Hot air evaporates soil moisture quickly, you get droughts. But hot air holds more water. So when it rains, it can rain really hard. So much flashier hydrology, droughts and floods. So what does this mean for human health? Well, This is a list of some of the obvious pathways through which climate change affects us. And it's why I've been studying this for more than two decades, because when you look at the direct effects from heat waves to air pollution and infectious diseases, especially those carried by insects and rodents, vector-borne diseases, and water-borne diseases, and then water supplies and food systems, and mental health and environmental refugees, all of these pathways through which climate affects us, I view climate change as the largest environmental public health crisis of our times. And each one of these pathways has a number of diseases and health outcomes associated. I won't talk about all of these because this is for the Department of Microbiology and Immunology. For today's lecture, except for a few surprises at the end, I'm going to talk about allergens, vector-borne and waterborne diseases. But first, before I talk about any specific disease, I want to talk about some indirect impacts that may be far more important than any disease outcome. These are some graphs from Syria. This was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences a few years ago. I know you can't read the graphs, but basically, less rain, higher temperatures, and Palmer drought index. It's really dry and a rising population. Well, in this paper, they found that Syria suffered the most severe drought in the instrumental record right before the Syrian civil war. It was documented that rural to urban migration rates were 4 to 5 times faster than normal. People were flooding into the cities because of the drought. There were food price shocks. There were riots in the street. Did this drought cause a Syrian civil war and the subsequent thousands of deaths and millions of refugees? Impossible to prove. But when you have extremes and strains on natural resources like this that destabilize a population, these can have enormous ripple events. And this is one of my biggest concerns about the effects of climate change on our health and well-being. Thinking about infectious diseases, refugee health, incredibly complex and a large problem. Either you're moving into places where you have no immunity to the diseases there, or you're bringing diseases in where the native population has no immunity. Forced population movement could be enormous for infectious diseases and a big challenge. Another aspect of immunology and infectious disease is nutrition. And this is a map from David Battisi of UW, Seattle, not to be confused with UW, Madison, Wisconsin. By the end of the century, let's just focus on the end of the century from 2080 to 2100, everywhere in red has a 90% probability of having record temperatures, record-breaking temperatures in the summer. And teaming up with Roz Naylor from Stanford, she calculated that those extreme temperatures would double the number of people at risk of hunger. So today's 800 million people at risk from hunger would be doubled by mid-century because of the extreme temperatures like this. Because you have a climatic envelope in which crops grow. If it gets too hot, you're in trouble. But there is something called the CO2 fertilization effect. CO2, plants grow more, right? And maybe the Western coal lobby that has a website called the Green Earth Society would make you believe that all the CO2 is great for greening up the earth. But according to this professor, who's done some amazing research looking at the effect of CO2 fertilization without adequate nitrogen in the soil, that plants actually will have less protein. And you're going to have to eat a lot more lettuce if you want to get the same nutrient value. So bad news for crops and food systems, which of course is important for immunological function and infectious disease. But I have some good news for you. Some plants will benefit. Poison ivy, for example. Does great with more CO2 and higher temperatures. Ragweed, also wonderful. There have been studies in Baltimore. Lou Ziska from the USDA planted ragweed, pots of ragweed plants on top of the Baltimore Science Museum on the roof, and with the extra CO2 in the environment from cars and industry and warmer temperature, the urban heat island effect, hot air, the concrete buildings and asphalt roads, you know, you get the urban heat island, it's warmer. These plants planted on the Baltimore Science Museum grew. They produced much more pollen compared to a rural area and a suburban area. So ragweed pollen increases. So good news for those of you who like poison ivy and ragweed pollen. So speaking of ragweed, Dr. Ziska led a study looking at pollen seasons across the United States, and you can see that especially in northern latitudes like Montana and Wisconsin, that we are having longer ragweed pollen seasons. So since the 50s, the state of Wisconsin has the CO2 has increased 27%. Our temperatures have warmed by 1 degree Fahrenheit according to Flux Tower data. Ragweed pollen season could be almost three weeks longer. But of course, maybe with the hygiene theory, that could be, if you have babies exposed to more pollen, that could be a good thing. But for many people with asthma, we worry about this, that already have asthma. Another problem with, especially with asthmatics, very high sensitivity to ozone. So ground level ozone is photochemical smog, the brown hazy smog. Ozone is not a directly emitted pollutant. It's formed by a chemical reaction. Nitrogen oxides that come out of your tailpipe and volatile organic compounds like the fumes from gasoline, the unburned fumes, they mix, and you need heat and sunlight to create ozone. So it's a very temperature sensitive pollutant, and with warmer temperatures, you might see pictures like this. When we published a study, the editors at Nature did not say regional health impacts. They talked about Chicago, the wheezy city. They thought our paper was about air pollution, but our paper was about heat waves. And the idea that in a heat wave, you get a stagnant air mass, and about a quarter to a third of the people that die in heat waves die from air pollution. And the effect of stagnant air masses can be a big problem when you're thinking about air pollution. And this is looking at, by mid-century, just from temperature alone, we could increase by 68% the number of red ozone alert days in the eastern United States, a big problem for asthmatics. Another surprise with climate change is that there are trees that give off volatile organic compounds, these isoprenes that are emitted from trees, and biogenic VOCs increase up to 30% for every 1 degree centigrade rise in temperature. This is from a scientist at NCAR in Colorado. So warmer temperatures, more isoprenes, more ozone formation. So for Montana, when you think about air quality, of course we're thinking about more wildfires. PM2.5 particles are very dangerous. And this is a study published last year in PLOS Medicine, looking at the wildfires in San Diego and the health burden. So wildfires and health, a big problem. So I want to shift gears because Raina's here and I'm supposed to talk about infectious diseases more. So that's all I'm going to say about immunology. I won't get in any deeper than that because I can't. I'm an environmental health scientist, remember? So the David Suzuki Foundation from Canada put out this, global warming's greatest threat may also be the smallest. So how many of you are students? Okay, this is a question for you. What's the difference between us mammals and that mosquito? Besides the fact that we can't fly, and Raina, you guaranteed me that at least 90% of the audience does not suck blood, right? Yes. So besides that, what's the difference? Insects versus mammals. Students, yes, temperature, and temperature control of the body. These are cold-blooded insects. We are warm-blooded. Our body temperature is always about the same. So as a cold-blooded mosquito, That means whatever the air temperature is, that's the body temperature of that insect. And if that mosquito is carrying dangerous parasites, that's going to have a direct effect on the development of the parasites. These are two of the main parasites that cause malaria: Plasmodium vivax, Plasmodium falciparum. This is the extrinsic incubation period, so the development time in the insect as opposed to in humans. So in that mosquito, the y-axis being temperature, you can see that as the temperature increases, the number of days it takes for that parasite to cross the stomach lining of the mosquito and develop into an infective sporozoite in the salivary glands. So when she takes her next bite, she transmits disease. It's temperature dependent. So at 20 degrees temperature, that mosquito carrying Plasmodium vivax will be infectious at day 18. But if it's 23 degrees, that mosquito is now infectious at day 13 or 14. So a little bit of temperature can have a huge effect on transmission dynamics. So let's take a look at our polar vortex right now. In Madison, tomorrow morning, it'll be negative 30 absolute temperature. In the summertime, it goes over 90. So negative 30 to plus 90, wouldn't an average person say, well, who cares about 1 degree temperature? Big deal. So when you're dealing with biological systems, like vector-borne diseases that involve cold-blooded insects, 1 degree warming means the difference between a small epidemic and a raging epidemic. Huge difference. So at your next cocktail party, when someone asks you that question, big deal, 1 or 2 degrees, you can tell them about malaria. And if you look at what happens, what's observed in a place like Zimbabwe, where the high plateau, high altitude, because all of you who live here know that as you go up in altitude, if you climb 1,000 meters, it's 6 degrees centigrade colder. For every 3,000 feet you climb, it's 6 degrees centigrade colder. And at the high plateau, we see very little malaria. But as you drop down to the Zambezi River and drop down in altitude in this direction, lower altitude, warmer temperatures, more malaria. And you can model this. Chris Ebi's group looked at the high altitude in Zimbabwe. These cooler colors, the yellows and greens, mean less climate suitability for malaria. But the climatologists are saying, hey, in 50 years, that region will be warmer and you will have more climate suitability for malaria transmission. So we're worried about the shifting geography of some of these vector-borne diseases. Now, closer to home, I'll talk briefly about the zoonotic disease, West Nile virus. Looking at genetic fingerprinting, it looks like it probably came in from the Middle East, and this probably in an infected mosquito in the wheel wells or something like that. That's the theory. So it's Culex mosquitoes through birds, and this is the natural cycle of this zoonotic disease. But horses and humans can be infected. We are irrelevant to the life cycle, though. So this came in from international travel. It landed in New York in July of 1999, took a couple of years, and then following migratory pathways, it marched across the United States, 2001, 2003, 2004. So almost pretty predictable that it was going to spread across the United States. But one interesting finding that Bill Risen found is that the strain of West Nile in the United States compared to other strains in Africa and Europe, in Eastern Europe, requires warmer temperatures. So the strain that came in here actually does better with warmer temperatures. And even with the evolution of this virus going across the country, there were places that were hot spots of transmission of West Nile. And it turned out that those hot spots of transmission literally were hot spots in temperature. So West Nile, it's complicated. There are a lot of other issues, but when it came into New York in July of 1999, that was the hottest July ever recorded in New York history. A different mosquito, this is Aedes aegypti, that carries yellow fever, dengue fever, and Zika virus. This mosquito is throughout the tropics. You can see where this mosquito occurs, and lots of dengue fever every year in East Asia. So there have been studies looking at when you have big epidemic years of dengue fever. Now, dengue is very seasonal. It happens at a high season in South America. It's March, April. In East Asia, I'm not sure. I can't remember which month it is. But it's very seasonal, up and down all the time, right? But why, when you look over 18 years of data from Southeast Asia, dengue is going up and down and up and down, and this is a big red line. So this red line, a peak year, 1997, 98, 2009 into 2010, peak year, these red spikes are major epidemics. Well, what happened in those 2 years? Well, it turned out those were very strong El Nino years. 1997, very strong, 2009. And during El Nino, it's very hot in Southeast Asia. So it was a temperature anomaly that drove an unusually high epidemic year of dengue fever. And in fact, 1997 was the strongest El Nino in recorded history until 2015 and into 2016. So the El Nino of 2015, the winter of 2015-16, had unbelievably hot temperatures. It was equal in strength. Now, many climatologists tell me, I can't say for sure that 2015 was recently the strongest. But what climatologists have told me I can say is that it was equal in strength to 1997, but lasted longer. So to me, as a non-climatologist, I'll say, I think it's just one of the strongest El Niños in recent history. So unprecedented temperatures throughout Colombia and Brazil. They had an amazing spike in dengue fever, and that's when Zika erupted. Now, because I'm in, this is a departmental lecture in microbiology, I will confess it's very complicated. There was international travel, a theory about the World Cup or a canoe race where Zika had erupted in the Pacific Islands, and people brought it into Brazil from international travel. That's how the virus got there. But just like when West Nile virus, carried by a different type of mosquito, entered New York, that was international travel. But did the record July 1999 temperature have anything to do with its taking hold? Because that strain does better with warm temperatures. Could this be a contributing factor? Well, people have studied this. And this was in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, showing that the ability of that mosquito to transmit Zika virus, called the vectorial capacity of Aedes aegypti mosquito, right during that El Nino period, was the highest potential for that mosquito to transmit dengue and Zika in the past 60 years. Zika virus and dengue fever are the same viral family. It's the same mosquito. So for all intents and purposes, I think the ecology of dengue and Zika are pretty identical. So did this strong El Nino have something to do with the Zika epidemic? I would posit that it had some contributing factor. So getting away from mosquitoes, I'll just show you one slide from Nick Ogden looking at Lyme disease, moving up. This is by end of the century, mid-century, currently the risk of Lyme disease moving up into Canada. Lyme disease is very complicated. People always ask me the relationship between climate change and Lyme disease, and I tell them it's complicated. It's more about land use and deer populations, although, of course, it's the white-footed mouse. It's the main reservoir for Lyme, the spirochete. But here's some modeling that shows that it could be moving northward for climate reasons. Now, again, because I have a climatologist in the audience, I have to say, remember, it's not just global warming. It's also extremes of the water cycle. And so we're worried, as far as infectious diseases, we have some concern about water contamination. Now, as Raina mentioned, I co-chaired the health report of the first U.S. national assessment. And the biggest surprise to us was how vulnerable our water systems are. And that right now in our relatively developed country of the United States, we have over a trillion gallons of sewage contaminated stormwater that overflows into our lakes and streams every year. That would keep Niagara Falls running for 18 days. That's today. That's the problem with heavy rainfall events and combined sewage overflows, because we still have communities who cannot afford or have not made the switch to separate stormwater runoff from sewage. So it's still a major problem. And the major concern for climate change, remember, warm air holds more moisture. So when it rains, it will pour. And we're going to see, this is from the U.S. Global Change Research Program, showing that globally, average globally, we're going to see these intensive rainfall events. We modeled these rainfall events for the Chicago water basin and found that by mid-century, and this is work with Sandra McClellan, that Chicago will see a doubling in the number of combined sewage overflow events because of the intensity of rainfall. That's a health problem. This is a photograph from Dr. Sandra McClellan at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, showing after a heavy rainfall what the Milwaukee Harbor looks like. And she goes out and samples the water every time it rains really hard, looking for E. coli. Well, look at the flaming blue-hot high numbers of E. coli at South Shore Beach and the flaming red-hot numbers of E. coli at Bradford Beach after a heavy rainstorm. So this is a recreational exposure risk. The water intake has been shifted way out further in Lake Michigan since the cryptosporidiosis outbreak, which we identified as having the heaviest rainfall month in its 50-year record of climate. So anyway, heavy rainfall, a risk to waterborne diseases. So I'm going to shift gears now. And there's another element here. And that is all these climate-sensitive diseases, where are they happening? You think about malnutrition, diarrheal disease, malaria. It's the poor countries. This is from the World Health Organization looking at climate-sensitive, where you have these diseases, where they're very prevalent, in poor countries. So this is climate-sensitive diseases. But who's causing climate change? Who's burning fossil fuels and creating greenhouse gas emissions? Well, looking at a 50-year aggregate, the United States is the number one most responsible country for the problem. Africa is not responsible. So in a sense, those most vulnerable are the least responsible. Per capita, Americans emit 6 times more CO2, the most abundant greenhouse gas, compared to the global average, or 30 or 40 times more than someone in a developing country. So we should be concerned about that. This is a data-driven cartogram. It got a lot of attention. And I was lucky enough to present this ethical dilemma to His Holiness the Dalai Lama 7 years ago. He is so smart. And he asked me a simple question. He said, "Jonathan, if you know pollution kills, your country's not showing much compassion, right?" And I started telling him, you know, we didn't know that air pollution was, we didn't know that burning coal was bad until the killer London smog event. And then we put scrubbers on smokestacks. We moved factories out of the cities. We didn't know that. And we didn't really know that greenhouse gas emissions were disrupting the Earth's climate until early 1990s. And he looked at me, he said, "Well, it's 20 years later, come on." And I told him, you know, we've got a fossil fuel-based economy. And then I just stopped for a second and I told him, "Let me get back to you on this." So I thought about it, and thinking about the cause of climate change being mostly burning fossil fuels, well, air pollution, when you burn coal and you create greenhouse gas emissions, you also create the nasty fine particles, PM2.5, and other pollutants that kill people. In fact, according to the World Health Organization, 7 million people die every year from air pollution. So what a golden opportunity to get off of fossil fuels, not just for climate reasons, but for immediate health benefits. And what about the problem of physical inactivity? According to the World Health Organization, More than 5 million people don't get enough exercise and die. 5 million people die every year from lack of physical activity. Also, related to fossil fuel-dependent transportation. There's a third sector I don't have time to talk about, but the food sector. High meat diet is not great for our hearts, nor is it great for the environment. So let's do a couple of simple things before I wrap up here. It might cost, on average, $30 to avoid emitting a ton of CO2. So the technology to avoid 1 ton of CO2 being released, it might cost you for clean energy, for clean technology. But when you burn coal or oil, you're also burning all those other nasty pollutants. So that for every 1 ton of CO2 that you don't burn, you avoid PM2.5, and you would save $200 in avoided mortality and health costs. So I want you to take a deep breath, because I'm going to ask you a really tough question. Imagine that you're in the government, okay? You're in the federal government or the state government. I'm going to ask you a really tough question, the next question, okay? Which number is bigger, 30 or 200? Now, I showed this in the state legislature in Wisconsin, and I was so glad some of the members came up and said, we never thought of this side of the equation. We've just been thinking about, well, we don't want to pay more for clean energy. Well, there's a huge benefit to getting to clean energy. And if you're in a very polluted place like in India, the benefit may be higher. In the United States, the amount of coal we burn, you can see where you will see less fatalities if you have cleaner energy. U.S. transportation contributes to sedentary lifestyles. 60% of Americans don't even meet the minimum recommended levels of exercise. Bozeman is an outlier. You guys have too many hiking trails and cross-country skiing. And so if you don't live in Bozeman, an average American, 60%, that's amazing. Obesity rates last year climbed to 40% in adults, 18% in children. 600,000 people die of heart attacks every year. But here's the thing, 40% of trips by car are really short trips, bikeable, maybe walkable with good transit. So a golden opportunity. We looked at this opportunity in the Midwest, graduate student Dr. Maggie Grabo, and the headline was swapping tailpipes for pedals, small changes could pay huge dividends. We'd save 13,000 lives every year, $8 billion saved in avoided mortality and hospitalization. So if we can design cities that are more bikeable or walkable, promoting active transportation, you can see comparing active cities versus less active, obesity rates lower, diabetes rates lower. So a golden opportunity for health. And of course, exercise is great for all these other outcomes. Finally, I want to just talk again about some political arguments. This is a report from the U.S. Energy Employment Report. If you're worried about fossil fuel jobs, there are 1 million jobs in our country in renewable energy. That's 5 times more jobs than compared to energy jobs from coal, oil, and gas combined. So from my point of view, jobs, income equals health. So the job story, there's a lot of jobs. Now for coal miners, we absolutely need to invest in coal mining communities. We can't burn any more coal, but we need to be serious and invest in coal mining communities. So I'll end by saying, regardless of one's opinion or views on climate change science, there's some real common ground. We can all support safe routes to schools, physically fit children and adults from cities designed for people rather than just for cars, clean air from low carbon energy, green jobs, and preserving natural resources for a healthy future. So I've, in my career, done a lot on the health risks from climate change because I think they are huge, but the climate change, there are challenges, but huge opportunities. And I say that solving the global climate crisis could be the greatest health opportunities of our times. But climate change, just a reminder, climate change is just right here. And this is looking at planetary boundaries and renewable resources. And once we go beyond the green circle, we're going beyond the capacity of nature to renew the resource. So we're starting to warm up the earth. Certainly species loss, when you lose a species, it's forever. all these other issues, land use change, carving up forests and doing things like that, these are all huge issues. Climate change by itself is a big one, but it's only one of many. And lucky, you're lucky enough here to have some brilliant researchers like Dr. Sarah Olson working on links between not only climate, but disruption of natural ecosystems in Africa and the emergence of Ebola. And of course, I always have to show this picture of the famous Dr. Raina Plowright discovering the links between deforestation and lack of food sources for the flying fox, as she discovered the ecological underpinnings for the emergence of Hendra virus. So I'll end by saying that confronting the global climate crisis is the greatest health opportunity of our lifetimes. And as far as confronting the problem, we can't afford not to. And if you want to learn more about this issue, you can go get this great book, Climate Change and Public Health, or you can Google my name and see the TEDx. So thank you very much for your attention. So do the models take into account better vaccines? No model is right, but some are useful, right? So as far as a Lyme disease, I doubt that the Lyme disease model accounted for changes in vaccines. What is the latest with the Lyme disease vaccine? I know it is okay in animals. Is it safe yet for humans? Not safe yet for humans. Seth says no go yet. But, you know, all of these models, you factor in, you try to control for some things. Some of the heat wave modeling, do you control for adaptation from air conditioning? We actually did a study last year where we accounted for air conditioning as an exacerbating problem because 40% of the air conditioning in the eastern United States comes from coal. So by running the air conditioners, you would kill an additional 1,000 people. We didn't compare to how many people you would save. So you would save lives from air conditioning. So air conditioning is good in a heat wave. But if the energy source for the electricity is dirty, you have a trade-off. But yeah, so all these models, either you have a control for adaptation or you don't, developing vaccines. I mean, if we have a vaccine for any of these infectious diseases, that'd be great. Influenza, yeah, that's a great question. Influenza also is tricky. Influenza is seasonal, happens mostly in the winter. The study, you know, we don't have it nailed down completely because it's not necessarily temperature. So colder winters do not mean necessarily more influenza. Some of the studies show that low humidity and more vulnerability of the respiratory tract may be one factor. So low humidity, and then the theory of in the wintertime, you're inside more. On the other hand, going against that theory, unfortunately, nowadays, we're always inside more compared to what we used to. So the influenza story is tricky. It's not an exact temperature effect, though. Right, so pathogens coming from permafrost. David?
Anthrax. Absolutely. Starting to show up in the northern coast of Siberia. Partly it's natural decomposition, and partly for economic reasons, a lot of people are digging fossils and selling the tusks of old mastodons, and therefore exposing the tissues that were carrying anthrax. We are seeing a small sliver, but renewed anthrax in North Siberia.
So, great question about, you know, the current administration making us lose traction and let this get completely away from us. So here's my view. What's going on in the federal administration is completely crazy, depressing, embarrassing, terrible. The resources and funding is a big deal, and the lack of regulation is a big deal. However, when you look at the groundswell all across the US and the rest of the world, at the city level, mayors stepping forward, pledging to be completely carbon free in 5-10 years. There's subnational, there's regional, there's what's it? It's the R20, which is regional. Well, there's C40 cities, big cities, and it's way more than 40 now. Michael Bloomberg and others pushing for big cities that are going carbon neutral. But there's also an R20, which is subnational regions banding together to act on things. There's so much happening at local levels and industry also, looking at the future saying, obviously we're going to low carbon. Let's plan for it, let's go that way. And they see money to be made. So between many industries and local governments, I'm still optimistic. I think the ridiculousness of our federal government right now, it's embarrassing, it is serious, but it's not holding back the floodgate of innovation and the local initiatives. And I think with the upcoming generation also demanding things, it's serious. We have to go completely off of fossil fuels in a hurry. But there are enough people, including industry, moving forward on this that I'm still optimistic. What's the story? Horton hears a who? Do you know that story? So we have to change the norms. So individually, everyone should be doing the right thing that's sustainable. People will not do what they should do. People will do what is convenient. So we need to design cities that are sustainable so that the fastest way to get around is by energy efficient transit and walking or safe biking. And I underline safe biking. Design it so it's safe. So you separate modes of travel. So it's got to be at the individual level, but also demand things at the community level. And then raise your voice at the national level too. You know, that does make a difference. So you have to hit it at every level. So I'm going to go back to our dinner conversation with Dr. David Carlson, who said, and if you think about the inertia of the climate system, greenhouse gases last for 50 to 100 years. So we're committed to some warming. David tells me we're committed, we're going to warm 2 degrees. But let's say if we went cold turkey, totally off of fossil fuel, and don't forget deforestation, that's about 15% of this problem is the loss of our carbon sink, deforestation. So stop deforestation, go fossil fuel free. What are we going to warm through, David? If we went perfectly, beautifully tomorrow, 1.5? 2.5, okay. So global average, remember, the land surfaces where people live are going to warm more than the oceans. So we are committed to some warming. But the question is, how much warming? So we have to get off of fossil fuels ASAP, so we stay at 2 or 2.5 instead of going to 4 or 5 or 6. Last question.
Do you have any knowledge on precedents for a public health challenge that's as interagency as this one? You know, on one hand, you have something like famine that, you know, the USDA might be the agency in charge of it. You've got institutional breakdown in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, where FEMA and maybe the Department of Defense is in charge of reacting to that sort of climate-induced crisis that also has a public health component. And in general, it just seems like these four horsemen are riding together.
Right.
You know, and then you get leptospirosis in Puerto Rico. So do you have good precedents of the sort of multi-agency coordination possible and necessary to meet this public
So that's a great question about the demand for interagency coordination to tackle such a complex, multifaceted problem of climate change. I can't answer the question. Probably that this will demand that type of coordination, and it's really important to understand the breadth of the problem so that people say, like, the wrong question is, what's more important, to get bed nets to the Congo to prevent malaria or work on climate change? That's not the right question. If you look at any single disease, I'd say the immediate, you know, the proximal prevention, bed nets and anti-malarials and mosquito control and things like that, will be really important, and it's not the right comparison to compare a single approach to a single disease versus a generalized, we need to go to low carbon because that warmer temperature will affect malaria in that location. It must be viewed in its full complexity, that getting to low carbon, which is so important, will have a huge benefit across many different pathways. And as far as getting to the solutions and the multi-agency cooperation, the cause of the problem, you know, food systems, transportation, housing and buildings, energy systems are really, they all have to be addressed. And it can't be one or the other. So I'll say maybe this requires unprecedented coordination compared to any other problem, but there are other problems too that do that too. But as we know, the world has problems and universities have departments. It's gonna, you know, we have to do this at the university level too. There's gotta be unprecedented collaboration as well. So with that, I thank you for your great questions.
You have been listening to a lecture entitled Climate Change Effects on Allergies and Infectious Diseases, recorded on January 29, 2019. It was given by Dr. Jonathan Patz, medical doctor and University of Wisconsin-Madison professor and director of the Global Health Institute, as well as 2007 Nobel Peace Prize winner. It was delivered at Montana State University Bozeman's Procrastinator Theater. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of KGVM's staff, board of directors, or contributors. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced for Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman, by Joy LaClaire.